Welcome to the Saxophone History Podcast, a thoughtful, researched, and slightly irreverent look at the history of our instrument. I'm your host, Andrew D. Meyer. To be honest, I didn't know much about the life of today's subject before doing the research for this episode. Sure, I could tell you about his stylistic traits and trace the influence he had through the decades, but I couldn't have told you anything about his actual life. Part of that is probably due to the fact that, like several of our past subjects, Lester Young was kind of a shy guy, so legendary grandstanding type moments that are easily passed on through oral history don't really exist. Also, Young did a lot of his really important work as a sideman in other musicians' bands. What we do know is that his subtle and lyrical style shaped the future of music for so many players. If we were looking at one of those, like, tree diagrams that show how players influenced each other, Lester Young would be one of the two main branches just above the trunk. So here we are with the story of Lester Young. Before we get into it, as usual, I'd like to acknowledge the primary source for this podcast. I thoroughly enjoyed Being Prez, The Life and Music of Lester Young by Dave Gelly. It's a really compact and very readable book that has a surprising amount of detail and color considering it's only a couple hundred pages. I really learned a lot from it, and I would definitely recommend it. Lester Willis Young was born on August 27, 1909 in Woodville, Mississippi. Other notable musicians born in 1909 include Benny Goodman, Gene Krupa, and Johnny Mercer, so he's in pretty good company. His father, Willis Handy Young, and mother, Lizetta Young, came from Louisiana. Lester had one brother and one sister. Lester's father, Willis, came from Thibodaux, Louisiana, and he followed in his father's footsteps to become a blacksmith. A man with a great intent to better himself, Willis was accepted to the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, where he studied many things but specialized in music. He sounds like a real grafter, studying all the instruments during the school terms and becoming highly proficient on the cornet, and then returning home to work in his father's forge when school was out. Imagine meeting someone like that, like with that kind of backstory on the bandstand. I suppose it was probably quite common for African Americans in that region to have to work like that. Lester's father moved to New Orleans after finishing school, became a teacher, and earned extra cash by teaching music lessons and playing the cornet, and eventually he became the leader of his own band. Both his teaching and performing work led Willis to be away from his home for long periods of time, and it seems like he was basically absent from raising his children. Lizetta Young, who was to become Willis's second wife, met Lester's father when she was one of his music students. She was light-skinned and likely descended from the mixed-race group of people called the gens de couleur libre, or free people of color who lived throughout Louisiana and the more French parts of the Caribbean during the time of slavery. These people formed their own social stratum and preferred to be distinct from freed slaves as they were born free. She would remain married to Willis for only a few years before he moved on to his third wife. Weirdly, when Willis left Lizetta, he got custody of his kids and sent his sister to collect them from Lizetta. The children wouldn't see their mother for 10 years. Woodville, Mississippi, where Lester Young was born, is a very old and very small town in Mississippi. The 2020 census put the population at 928. This is only interesting because this very small town of approximately 1 square mile produced not only Lester Young, but also Jefferson Davis, who would go on to lead the Confederacy, and also the composer William Grant Still was from this weird little town, so there must be something in the water there. Young was born into an inhospitable world. Segregation was strictly enforced, and one would imagine the brutality used in backwoods places like Woodville, where blacks outnumbered whites twofold to be extreme. Lynchings and other broad daylight violence were not uncommon, and justice was rare. The so-called second Ku Klux Klan began in 1915 when Lester was just 6 years old. Luckily, at just a few weeks old, he was taken to New Orleans, where he would grow up in the Algiers neighborhood in his family home. Lizetta, Lester's mother, her parents lived in Woodville, and the only reason he was born there was because she was nervous about the birth and she just like wanted to be with her parents for support, right? After Lester was born and everyone was sure that he was healthy, they made a hasty exit for Louisiana. Algiers is on the opposite side of the Mississippi River from New Orleans, you know, opposite the French Quarter, basically. Though not exactly equal with its more famous Cross River neighborhood, Algiers was home to a lively jazz scene and several notable regional jazz figures. It was nicknamed Brooklyn of the South, which referenced the proximity of Algiers to New Orleans being similar to that of Brooklyn and Manhattan. Brass bands were quite common in Algiers, just as they are in the French Quarter, though still strictly segregated. One would imagine that growing up as a young African-American in Algiers would offer much more in terms of opportunities, and at least a bit of a chance to cast off the shackles of oppression amongst your own people. Indeed, Young seems to have had a happy childhood, which is how he described it when he would speak of growing up in Algiers later in life. Many of Young's earliest memories are musical, which is not surprising considering that New Orleans held the reputation of being the most musical city in America. Lester and a guitarist called Danny Barker, who was the same age, both described frequently being outside doing, you know, whatever kids do, and all of a sudden hearing music coming from somewhere, to which they would frantically run off in search of the source. All social functions in the region were practically required to have music, whether a party, funeral, religious ceremony, wedding, or any of the dozens of other reasons humans gather. Many of these events would have taken place outdoors, so the idea of music just wafting around on the breeze is an apt portrait of life in Algiers. Young was sweet-natured as a child, a trait which would stay with him for life. He was known to go out of his way to avoid conflicts throughout his life, and it seems that this is rooted in his early days spent with his doting mother, with whom he was quite close. That sunny and pleasant childhood came to an abrupt end when Young's father left his mother and took his children away from Lizetta. When they were picked up by Willis's sister, they weren't even told what was happening. They were essentially tricked into believing that they were going for a little trip. It seems that Willis wanted to take the children with him so that he could train them to be musicians and use them in his band, the New Orleans Strutters. He was already employing several members of his extended family in the band, which was engaged to perform with the Hagenbeck and Wallace Circus. The New Orleans Strutters had their own tent and essentially performed like minstrel shows. Young began his musical training playing the drums, but quickly tired of having to lug around and set up all of the necessary bits and pieces. As he developed an interest in girls, he realized that by the time he had packed up all of his drums, all the best-looking girls had attached themselves to musicians who simply threw their instruments in their cases and were ready to go. It's an age-old story, right? To remedy this, Young's father gave him an alto saxophone to learn and let his younger brother take over the drums. The family band worked pretty relentlessly, spending roughly half the year with the Hagenbeck and Wallace Circus, and the other half working the TOBA circuit. TOBA, which stood for Theater Owners Booking Association, but was more commonly said to stand for Tough on Black Asses, was like a booking cartel known for its rough treatment of black performers in the South. When working this well-established circuit, the New Orleans Strutters would travel by rail, which was occasionally made easier by Willis's status as a Freemason, which sometimes curried favor with fellow Freemasons working as train conductors or Pullman staff. Keep in mind that Lester Young was in his early teenage years when he was working with this group. In 1924, when Lester was only 15 years old, the group had performances stretching all the way from Seattle to Pensacola. While these far-ranging tours provided steady work and a chance for Lester to progress as a saxophonist, they meant that he received little in terms of formal education. Schools for black children in the South were notoriously poor anyway, so his absence from them wasn't the end of the world. And he wasn't completely illiterate, but he was certainly not a literary man. Later in life, he would pass off hotel registration forms to his tour managers to avoid struggling with the printed text. The music played in the family band shows was of the type common to minstrel shows. Very catchy tunes, often with bawdy themes. While these types of tunes would likely have made up the core repertoire of the group, obviously there's a bit of speculation here, as recording was not a thing at these shows, and scant records were kept. The blues was also starting to make its way into these performances. This mix of popular song and the blues was what Lester Young cut his teeth on as he honed his craft and became a professional musician. Young learned the saxophone very quickly and began to get a little reputation as something of a star in the show. He had a great ear and was quick to learn tunes upon hearing them. As is the case with many young musicians with this innate ability, learning to read music seemed like a chore and wasn't something that he was interested in. His father, however, insisted that the young saxophone prodigy learn to read properly. But Young was able to fool his father's demands for a short while by simply playing things after hearing them only once. Suspecting this was the case, Willis wrote out a melody on the blackboard for Lester to play and then demonstrated it, adding in several additions that were not in the written line. Lester, pretending to read the line, walked right into the trap and played exactly what his father had played. This led to his banishment from the bandstand until he learned to read properly. Though Young took his banishment quite hard, it probably did pay off for him, as reading would open up new opportunities for work in the future. As a young man, he felt the sting of his punishment acutely and remembered it for the rest of his life. This is just one example of the many disagreements between father and son. And it's really sad, actually. Everyone who observed the situation said that Lester's clear talents were a source of pride for Willis, and Lester was very much the favorite child, yet Willis's hard discipline, taskmaster personality meant that he could never admit how he felt about his son's accomplishments. To make matters worse, Willis was liberal with lashing his children as punishment, which Lester, sensitive kid that he was, just simply, he couldn't bear it. This led to a situation where, from the age of about 11 years old, Lester would simply run away for periods of time rather than endure the punishments. Apparently, he was quite good at surviving on his own because no one knew where he would go or how he managed on his own. Eventually, he would turn up again and life would just sort of resume as usual. I mean, think about how crazy that is. These guys are on the road somewhere between Seattle and Pensacola, and this 11-year-old kid is just running off and somehow surviving on his own, and then coming back and everyone's just like, oh, everything's fine. In the winter of 1926-27, the New Orleans Strutters took a break from their usual winters on the Toba circuit in the South and instead took up a semi-permanent residence in Minneapolis, of all places. I mean, who chooses to move to Minneapolis in the winter, right? I suppose that says something about the Toba circuit, if you'd rather endure the bitter cold of Minnesota in winter than work in those conditions. Life in Minnesota allowed the family to remain in one place for a while and to enjoy the benefits of living in a non-segregated city. This meant that Lee, Lester's younger brother, was able to get some regular schooling of good quality. Lester and his sister Irma were by this point 17 and 14, respectively, and did not benefit from this opportunity, as 14 was the age at which compulsory schooling ended. Sort of like, well, you're 14 now, son. You best get down the mines like everyone else. Musical tastes were changing while the band was in Minneapolis, with minstrelsy falling out of fashion in favor of larger bands more suited to dancing than slapstick comedy shows. It wasn't quite big band music yet, but that development was right around the corner. Keep in mind, this is 1926-27. The Pendergast regime is already in control in Kansas City and beginning to lay the foundation of the liberal laws that regulated nightlife that would lead to the development of the Kansas City sound only a few years later. The New Orleans Strutters were quick to catch on to this trend, with Lester's father enlarging the band to include two trumpets, two trombones, three saxophones, piano, banjo, tuba, and drums. It's very much in the sort of New Orleans model, with banjo and tuba in the rhythm section, as opposed to guitar and double bass. But you can see the additional brass players leading to something more like a modern big band with saxophone, trombone, and trumpet sections. The band worked regularly at the Southside Ballroom as well as the Radisson and the St. Paul Hotel. This winter in the far north was no doubt a pleasant change for the group, and the addition of more players was certainly a big development. But possibly the most important event in the Lester Young story from this winter sojourn occurred on a brief tour of the Dakotas, where Lester Young first heard a recording of Frank Trumbauer. Eddie Bearfield, who was a musician staying at the same lodging house as Young, and soon to be friend of the young saxophonist, was listening to a Trumbauer record one night when he heard a knock at the door inquiring who was playing saxophone on the record. Throughout his life, Lester Young would only ever admit to having one influence on his playing, Frank Trumbauer. Young claimed to have tried to imitate the sound of Trumbauer's C melody saxophone. Indeed, there are obvious similarities between the sort of floating quality that both players had and in the lightness and restraint in their tones. Thomas Cunniff points out two things that are pretty interesting about Young encountering these Trumbauer recordings. First, these were among the first recordings that were widely available, meaning that Young and his generation were the first to be able to study music without having to be present at the source. He also points out that the saxophone was probably not played very well in general, particularly in the more remote regions. Unlike the trumpet or clarinet, which had, you know, like well-established pedagogies and pretty famous soloists, the saxophone was still quite new and frequently used as more of like a novelty instrument for sound effects in minstrel shows. So hearing Trumbauer's restrained tone and very precise technique likely showed Young another path that he could take with his saxophone playing. Another saxophone player whom the young Lester Young was partial to was Rudy Weidhoff, who was an incredibly technical early saxophonist. Weidhoff didn't really play classical music, but what he did certainly wasn't jazz. He played sort of a mix of ragtime and flashy show-type pieces that could probably be called, like, light classical, I guess. Weidhoff played with extremely clean technique and a sharp articulation, but was known to incorporate big scoops, bends, and novelty sounds in his playing. Even though the music is quite different from the direction Young was headed in, I can see how a young player who's quite serious about learning the instrument would gravitate to people like Weidhoff, who were so incredibly technically proficient, especially as that would have likely contrasted with what he was hearing in the minstrel circuit. Young was also known to listen to Bix Beiderbecke and Benny Goodman as early inspiration for his playing. I mean, no surprises there, really. It's reported that Young's ear was his main source of musical training, and it's said that he could listen to a record once in a shop and then go home and not only play back what he had heard, but also harmonize it. In 1927, after a successful winter of working in the hotels of Minneapolis, a spate of prohibition-related gangster violence broke out in the city. This meant a moral panic resulting in curfews and increased surveillance of nightlife, which restricted the work opportunities for musicians. Perhaps sensing the way the winds were blowing, Young's father decided it was time to pack up the band and head south. He began booking a southern tour, which was to end in Arizona, which Lester argued strongly against, citing the treatment that they would receive in the South and the generally just sort of less prestigious quality of the work, but his father was not to be deterred. As the group made their way south, Lester decided he wasn't going to be subjected to that kind of treatment again and left the band in Salinas, Kansas. He was 18 years old, so there was very little that his father could do except tell him that his instruments would stay behind because they belonged to the band. Lester agreed, gave up his saxophone, and stayed behind in Salinas. He was quickly able to borrow a saxophone and found work playing at the Wiggly Cafe. Two other members of the New Orleans Strutters followed Young's lead and left the group a few weeks later. And when these guys arrived in Salinas, they tracked down Young, who told them that he had met up with Art Bronson, who was looking to beef up his six-piece band to a 10-piece. His band was a territory band called the Bostonians, though they had no known connection to Boston of any sort. I'm going to go down a bit of a rabbit hole on the territory bands because they were a super important part of the music scene through large parts of the American West and were instrumental in the development of big band jazz in Kansas City, both in terms of bringing new talent into the city and for exporting new musical ideas out to the wider public. Hint, I mean, this is sort of where the story of Lester Young is going. Also, a big part of the audience for this podcast is from outside the U.S., and I have a feeling that maybe explaining exactly what territory bands were might be kind of a useful exercise for people not from America. Territory bands were dance bands that traveled relentlessly within a certain region or territory. These bands were in operation more or less from the 1920s to the 1960s and played a really important role in spreading popular music, both in terms of tunes and in terms of larger stylistic trends through the sheer number of miles they logged. Like, they literally carried the music to all these places. Territory bands are largely credited with the popularization of many ballroom dance styles after World War I, as well as the popularization of swing music. Though territory bands existed pretty much all over America, I tend to associate them with the West for a few reasons. Territory bands filled a gap that was left by major booking agents who simply wouldn't book their acts into towns below a certain size for economic reasons. Think about it. If you lived in a small town on the Great Plains in the early 1920s, your chances of hearing music of any quality, let alone whatever the hot new trends were, would have been pretty limited. Radio broadcasting was in its infancy, starting in 1920, and the second wave of recording technology wasn't going to come out until sort of the middle of the decade, the middle of the 1920s. Big-time bookers wouldn't book traveling orchestras or big stars like Louis Armstrong or Duke Ellington in your town because there just weren't enough people around to make it financially viable. This is where the territory bands came in. By covering your region, it became economical for them to hit your town every couple of months and provide some much-needed entertainment. On a side note, you can imagine what a crazy gig that would have been to play, to play an endless stream of just tiny hick towns who waited all month for any kind of excitement you brought in. That sounds pretty fun to me. Territory bands were often seen as sort of a second tier of bands roaming the nation. They cost less and were therefore affordable for smaller venues and towns, and were also something of a stepping stone for younger players to cut their teeth before attempting to find a chair in one of the major big bands. Keep in mind, players like Lester Young, Ben Webster, Charlie Parker, etc. are all going to get their starts in these types of bands. It's easy to see how they played a major role in the musical ecosystem. Though these bands were largely working bands that didn't have the sort of fame that the major big bands had, a few bands did rise to some prominence, including Walter Page's Blue Devils, Jay McShawn's band, Andy Kirk and his 12 Clouds of Joy, Benny Moten's Kansas City Orchestra, the Wolverines, and a few others. There were some truly great band names in those days, too, like Smiling Billy Stewart's Celery City Serenaders, Zach White's Chocolate Bow Brummels, Snooks and his Memphis Stompers, the Happy Black Aces, and Peck's Bad Boys. I think that one's my favorite. It should be noted that while this business was largely a male-dominated one, all female bands were a thing that existed, and a few gained places of prominence. Groups such as the Harlem Playgirls, the Darlings of Rhythm, the Dixie Sweethearts, and many more covered the span from sort of highly polished outfits to rather degrading novelty acts and really everything in between. Territory bands generally stayed within their own territories, and several of these became quite codified, such as MINK, which stood for Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, and Kansas, VSA, which was Virginia, South Carolina, and Alabama, and then Texas, which as usual just sort of developed its own thing. The bands that existed around Kansas City, such as Benny Moten's band, Jay McShawn's band, and the Oklahoma City Blue Devils, were comprised of some of the most influential working musicians of the era, especially when they came together under the direction of Count Basie. But I'm getting ahead of myself here. Back to Lester Young striking out on his own in Salina, Kansas. So Lester Young is playing in Al Bronson's Bostonians, which was a 10-piece territory band that was covering basically the exact area that Lester had been begging his father to stick to rather than heading back to the segregated South. Bronson's band was quite popular, and it wasn't uncommon for them to attract audiences of up to 3,000 patrons at a time, which is quite a crowd to play for with essentially no amplification, especially when they're dancing. Lester was playing alto with the group, but switched to tenor basically because the regular tenor player was unreliable. According to Young, the regular tenor player came from a bit of money, and so he didn't come up through this hard-working touring band lifestyle that the others were used to. In describing his gripes about this guy, Lester seemed particularly annoyed that he would take a long time to get his shirt and tie on and would make the rest of the band wait around until he was ready. Lester told Bronson that if he would buy him a tenor, he would play it and then they would be rid of this nuisance. So Bronson jumped at the chance, and from then on, Young was a tenor player. Incidentally, it was a super beat-up Con Pan American tenor that Young started on, which is not really the best of horns. The Pan American was a subsidiary of Con that made their student level horns, a bit like Bundy is to the Selmer Corporation, I guess. or Selmer, USA. Young would stay with Bronson until 1929, when he returned to his family band, who had taken up residency in Albuquerque for a while. There isn't really much in terms of like recorded history of what he was doing, what he was up to during those 2 years that he was with Bronson, but we can safely assume that he was working dance gigs pretty much every night, playing a variety of dance styles, and likely improvising in blues idioms on popular songs, though not really in what we would think of as a jazz context yet. This would have been a major opportunity for him to like really get his playing together. Newly reunited with his family band, Lester found that his father had taken a new young tenor player and was teaching him to read and hone his craft, much as he had done with Lester. This budding young tenor player turned out to be none other than Ben Webster. The two became close, practicing together each day and developing alongside one another. Webster actually saved Young's life one day when they were swimming in the Rio Grande and Young got into trouble with the currents. Young also met his first wife, Beatrice Tolliver, during this stay in Albuquerque, and the two shortly moved to Minneapolis. The marriage didn't work out, and Young seems to have gotten together with a woman named Bess Cooper, who died giving birth to his daughter, Beverly. Beverly says that Young kept in touch with her his entire life, buying her a piano, amongst other things, and even taking her on tour on occasion. Again, details are scant for many parts of Young's life, particularly early on. Just as it's not really clear what he was doing while working for Bronson, it's not really clear what happened with his marriage, nor is it clear how he managed to work briefly in a saxophone duo with his old friend Eddie Bearfield, who had introduced him to Frank Trumbauer Records a few years earlier. Bearfield claimed that the two of them somehow played school dance-type gigs just as a duo without any sort of rhythm section. Like, just the two saxophones were playing at some weird school dance parties in Minneapolis. I would love to go back in time and see what that was like and what they were playing. Young wouldn't languish long doing these weird duo gigs in Minneapolis, as he soon took a job with Walter Page's Blue Devils. The Blue Devils were probably the most important of the territory bands in terms of the development of jazz, and Young was in at the ground level, though this first of many engagements with the band was to be a short one. After finishing playing the Ritz Ballroom in Oklahoma City, the band was slated to travel to Little Rock, Arkansas, which, being a southern segregated city, was not something that Young was willing to endure. Instead, he signed back on with his old boss, Al Bronson. In 1932, Young rejoined the Blue Devils, but again, the gig ended pretty roughly. The Blue Devils operated as a sort of like musical co-op, with all members being equal partners in the endeavor. This was perhaps a kind of radical and frankly very cool thing, but also left the band open to hardship. Rather than being salaried musicians getting a regular weekly fee, the group simply paid expenses from whatever they earned and then divided up the remains equally. This worked great when they had regular engagements, but the lack of cash reserves meant that there were no salaries when things got rough. As the Depression took its toll and a series of poor audiences and shady promoters in West Virginia and Kentucky put the band on hard times, the musicians, including Young, found themselves at the end of their road, with their instruments even being impounded over unpaid debts in Newport News, Virginia. The guys literally had to learn how to catch trains from Depression-era hobos in order to get back to Kansas City. When Young arrived back in Kansas City with no money, no clothes, and no instrument, his luck, it turned around rather quickly when he ran into Pete Jones, the trombone player who had defected from the family band in Salinas. Jones was working with King Oliver, who was looking for a tenor player, and hired Young on the spot. Oliver was at the sort of end of his career, just barely surviving the transition to the dance band era, but he was able to keep Young in work for about 6 months during 1933. While these early years of touring were no doubt hard and didn't bring Young any money or fame to speak of, he certainly built a reputation as a unique and very talented player. Word of his abilities spread largely through rumor, as players would encounter him in various small towns throughout the Midwest and the Plains states. Players would usually encounter Young in jam sessions involving various musicians crossing paths on their various tours. It was in these sessions that the idea of riffs became such a thing. These repetitive two- or four-bar phrases would form the basis of big band jazz in Kansas City in years to come, and was a concept developed by Young and his peers at these impromptu sessions throughout the Midwest. It sounds a bit silly speaking about riffs and how groundbreaking this was, but this approach to making music and the space that it created for improvisation was truly a novel concept at the time. Jumpin' at the Woodside is a great example of this type of tune in its fully fleshed out version, with the main riff repeating and serving as a jumping off point for soloists. And 1 o'clock Jump was literally put together to fill time during a live radio broadcast from the Reno Club. The riff tunes that developed as vehicles to quickly put together material for jam sessions were the form that would become a major part of Lester Young's future. The content was the blues. The region of the United States where the blues originated and filtered through virtually all forms of popular entertainment is a great triangle that extends from Kansas City down to Texas in the west and Georgia in the east. Almost all of Lester Young's early life had been spent in this fertile blues territory. Young would refer to his playing as telling your story, which is very much in the style of solo blues musicians who would accompany their own voices on roughly hewn guitars with improvised slides. After about 6 months with King Oliver, Young quit the band when Oliver was getting ready to take the group on a southern tour. He had made Kansas City and all that it had to offer his home. Kansas City, that's Kansas City, Missouri, was a wild town that played host to probably the highest number of cabarets, dive bars, gin mills, gambling dens, and dance halls anywhere in the world, other than maybe, I don't know, Singapore. The whole operation was overseen by Tom Pendergast, who was the chair of the Jackson County Democratic Party. He only once briefly held office, but otherwise found his power through his influence at the helm of the Democratic Party. Throughout Prohibition, Pendergast made it known that Kansas City was wide open for any type of business, especially vice. Prohibition had been lifted in 1933, just as Lester Young was leaving King Oliver and settling into life in Kansas City. He basically inherited a city that was wide open and clamoring for music. Incidentally, Tom Pendergast helped Harry Truman to get his start in politics. With all these venues demanding music, there was ample work for musicians, though much of it was terribly paid. Further, the long hours that were required to cover all of the demand, remember, jukeboxes wouldn't be out until like the 1940s, and that meant that riff tunes and blues forms allowed musicians to generate tunes largely on the spot, rather than, you know, shelling out for loads of arrangements, which were expensive and took time to produce. Lester Young fit into this model exceptionally well with his ability to hear things once and easily play them back. Young quickly found work with Clarence Love's band playing at the El Toreo ballroom before joining Benny Moten and his orchestra a few weeks later for their opening at Club Harlem. By the time that Young had joined Moten, the band had become the best known and most respected black orchestra in the region. Moten had basically swallowed up Walter Page's group, the Blue Devils, after Page grew frustrated with the hassles of leading his own group. Moten enjoyed both a good reputation amongst musicians and the protection from the Pendergast machine. He was a smooth operator and a sharp businessman. He was said to know the pay schedules for various industries and to promote his dances around them. His band also had the rare distinction amongst these early big bands of recording frequently, and it's possible to basically trace the development of Kansas City jazz by listening to his discography in chronological order. In particular, the switch from sort of like a two-beat feel to four even beats, and then the reconfiguration of the rhythm section with double bass and guitar replacing the tuba and banjo can be clearly heard in Moten's recorded legacy. While Moten was certainly the most prominent bandleader in town at the time of Lester Young's arrival, his position wouldn't remain unchallenged for long. For some unknown reason, a major split occurred in Moten's band, with its pianist and arranger, one Count Basie, and several other musicians leaving to form their own outfit. Herschel Evans was the tenor player for the group led by Basie until the following year, 1934, when Evans and Young essentially traded jobs. At this point, Lester Young is still basically an unknown figure. He's known to musicians in the area working the territory band circuits, but he doesn't have a recording career or any sort of fame. Coleman Hawkins is the main man on the national scene when it comes to tenor players. In fact, he had basically invented the genre of jazz tenor playing. Though he was only 5 years older than Young, he already had a very established career and was playing with Fletcher Henderson. I'm definitely going to cover Coleman Hawkins in the future. I don't know if that'll be the next episode after these Lester Youngs, or I might take a break and do something different. Anyway, all of the tenor players in Kansas City and everywhere else knew of Coleman Hawkins. They would have all heard his records, so when Fletcher Henderson came to Kansas City, Lester Young and all the other players were excited to hear him play live. Young says that he went to hear Hawkins play but didn't have any money, so he stood outside to listen. But Hawkins never showed up. Perhaps knowing that all these tenor players would be skulking around outside trying to hear the band for free, Fletcher Henderson came out to try to find someone to cover his absent star's chair. Young described the scene. Quote, "I ran a million miles to hear Coleman Hawkins play, and he wasn't there. So Fletcher Henderson ran out saying, 'Don't you have no tenor players here in Kansas City? Can any of you play?' Herschel was out there, you dig, but he couldn't read. So they say, 'Red,' they call me Red then, 'Red, go and blow this goddamn saxophone.' And I'm coming to see Coleman Hawkins. They told me how great he was. So they showed me in, and I get up and grabbed his saxophone and played the motherfucker and read the music and read his clarinet parts and everything," unquote. It's pretty incredible that he did this and succeeded. Multiple witnesses corroborated the story, including Herschel Evans. Young managed to play a stranger's instrument on challenging arrangements and soloed with the band to great success in front of one of the most famous bands in the nation, while the majority of Kansas City's tenor players looked on. Though he didn't get to hear Hawkins that night, Young would have an encounter with the famous tenor man that became the stuff of jazz lore. The next time the Henderson band was in town, Hawkins did make the date, and afterwards was found to be jamming in the after-hours session at the Cherry Blossom with Ben Webster, Herschel Evans, and Lester Young. Apparently, Hawkins was not expecting to face such quality tenor playing and played all night with his shirt off trying to play something to outdo these three young upstarts. Mary Lou Williams recalled that she was woken up about 4 a.m. to Ben Webster knocking on her window saying, "Get up, pussycat, we're jamming, and all the pianists are tired out now. Hawkins has got his shirt off and is still blowing. You got to come down." Later that year, Young had an offer that was at once enticing and also terrifying for the sensitive young player. He had continued playing with whoever was hiring and wasn't really progressing in terms of career, though he was definitely gaining quite a reputation as a tenor player on the scene in Kansas City. Coleman Hawkins, who had been with Fletcher Henderson for about 10 years at this point, was looking to move on and found work in England with bandleader Jack Hilton. Remembering Young's somewhat spectacular debut with the band when Hawkins had failed to show, Henderson offered Hawkins' position to Young. You might think that this would be the dream ticket and that Young would have jumped at the chance to go to New York and take on this major soloist position with one of the most famous bands of the era, but remember that Young was a very sensitive and shy character. He told his friend Buddy Tate, quote, "I think I could make it, but I understand the band is full of cliques, and I just don't know how they'll treat me," unquote. He also said that he was worried of the shame that he would incur if he went for the job and had to return in failure. Luckily, Young worked up the nerve and went for the job with Henderson. In Kansas City, he had been averaging about $14 a week, and with Henderson, his weekly take-home jumped to $75. Henderson agreed to let him stay with him, likely because Young was so nervous about being in New York on his own. In a press release to announce his joining the band, John Hammond said, quote, "Hawkins' successor is a sensation, I'm told. I haven't heard this red-headed star, but no less than 10 swell Harlemites have told me that he swings more than Hawkins and has actually cut the master on occasions," unquote. Upon joining the band, there was a major problem that was immediately apparent. Young's sound was so much lighter and less forceful than Hawkins that the arrangements didn't work. The configuration of Henderson's woodwind sections was one clarinet, two altos, and a tenor, which worked with the booming quality of Hawkins' playing, but sounded out of balance and with too much treble when Young's lighter sound filled the low harmony. To make matters worse, the rumors that Young had heard that the band was quite cliquish turned out to be true, and the band turned on the new joiner almost immediately. John Hammond described the first time he heard Lester Young with the Fletcher Henderson Band. Quote, "Lester would get up and play, you know, and I just couldn't believe my ears. I'd never heard anything like this in my life. And I said, Fletcher, he's just the best saxophone player I ever heard. And Fletcher said, I know he is, John, but nobody likes him." Unquote. Henderson had a real dilemma on his hands. He had hired the best soloist on the scene, but his arrangements weren't really working, and the guys in the band hated his guts for it. Henderson's wife, Lenora, attempted to remake Young in Hawkins' image. She would wake him up by playing Hawkins' records and take him to various music shops to try out reeds and mouthpieces and things in an attempt to beef up his sound. Knowing now the influence that Lester Young had on players, I think we can consider it lucky that Young had such a strong vision of how he wanted to play and was resistant to these attempts to change his style, right? You know, if he doesn't have this successful career playing in his own way, like, do you get Stan Getz? Do you get Charlie Parker? Do you get Jerry Mulligan? Do you get, you know, the list goes on. Like, do you get any of these players? Like, it's good that he, you know, stuck to his guns, right? While he was struggling with the dominating Lenora Henderson, Young began what would become a lifelong friendship with a 19-year-old unknown singer called Billie Holiday, whom he met at a jam session. Billie and Lester became fast friends, with Lester frequently seeking out where Billie was singing to sit in or just to listen. Holiday loved having him solo behind her. The two smoked loads of weed together and drank what they called top and bottoms, which was a drink they invented that was half gin and half port, which sounds pretty grim. Young called her Lady Day, and Billie Holiday is the one who began calling Lester Young Prez. Actually, she called him President after Franklin D. Roosevelt because he was the best man around, and it eventually was just shortened to Prez. It's not entirely clear whether this account is accurate or not, and several people from Young's early Kansas City days claim to have called him Prez before Holiday. But the most commonly told legend is that Billie Holiday was the one to coin this sobriquet. Young lasted about 4 months in the Hostile Henderson operation before he left. To ensure that he didn't return to Kansas City in shame, he asked Henderson to write him a letter of recommendation. Henderson was happy to oblige, most likely relieved that he wouldn't have to fire him or suffer the situation any longer. As Young was leaving, Henderson pulled his other three reed players in for a dressing down, reportedly telling them, quote, "It looks like I'm going to have to let this boy go, because he'll never have any peace around here with you. But I just want to tell you something before he goes. He can outplay you, and you, and you, and you're going to hear about him," unquote. It's doubtful that Lester Young would have needed any sort of recommendation from Henderson to find another job, but I suppose it was a way of proving to himself that he didn't leave the band in disgrace or failure or something. It didn't really matter anyway, because he basically swapped jobs with Ben Webster upon leaving Henderson. Webster, who had been playing with Andy Kirk's Clouds of Joy, took Young's vacated chair with Henderson, and Young took Webster's job with Kirk. Dave Gelly points out an interesting difference between Lester Young and many of his contemporaries. At this point in the story, Young is about 25 and has not done any recording that can be proven. Most of his fellow notable saxophonists had at least a few short recorded solos to their names, but we have no documented evidence of how Lester Young sounded during this early part of his career. We only have, as Gelly says, memories of dead people. The engagement with Kirk didn't last long, and a short period of bouncing around and generally playing whatever gigs he could book began. Most of this work was well beneath Young's level, but in Kansas City, there was a real glut of talent, which came from far and wide on the promise of steady work. Young bounced back and forth between Minneapolis and Kansas City during this time, booking casual work in Minneapolis, and then drifting back to Kansas City for the legendary jam scene. One night, however, this drifting existence was to come to an end. Young heard Count Basie and his Barons of Rhythm broadcast live from the Reno Club and knew he wanted a shot at playing with the band. Young said he loved everything about the band's more modern style, everything except for the tenor playing of Slim Freeman. He wrote to Basie and basically just asked him for the tenor chair, to which Basie agreed. And that was that. Lester Young was off with Count Basie. Basie was booked in to play at the Club Reno. He had a band consisting of 3 saxophones, 3 brass, and 3 in the rhythm section, which was the result of his successfully convincing Reno club owner Sol Steibold to spring for a 9-piece band instead of the 6-piece he had been booking. The band was booked to play from 9 at night until 5 in the morning, which included 4-hour-long floor shows and dancing music in between. In return for their efforts, the band received $18 a week each, with Basie taking an extra $3 for his efforts as leader. I guess keep that in mind the next time you're complaining that you've been booked in for hour-long sets instead of 45 minutes. All the musicians in Basie's band had similar backgrounds. They were steeped in the blues and had all spent time working the territory band circuits. This communal knowledge of the repertoire and extensive blues jamming experience meant that very few arrangements were really necessary, and most things were just sort of worked out in real time on the bandstand. If you think about how many hours the band was filling on those 9-to-5 Reno club gigs, this type of practice really makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's just efficient. So with the Reno Club, you've got this unique situation where some forward-thinking musicians come together, all with extensive abilities and knowledge of their craft. They're put through the crucible of extremely long hours of playing, which results in a major stylistic development. That, in and of itself, would be quite remarkable. But what makes this situation even more important was that the Reno Club was wired up for live radio broadcast, which was an exploding technology in the 1930s. WGKBY, which broadcast the late night sessions, had a very powerful transmitter, so that when most stations in the region would go off air late at night, one of the only things to be heard for hundreds of miles across the Midwestern plains was Count Basie playing this new Kansas City sound. John Hammond described hearing one of these broadcasts in Chicago late one night. Quote, "I couldn't believe my ears. Basie had developed an extraordinary economy of style, using perfectly timed punctuations, a chord, even a single note, which could inspire a horn player to heights he had never reached before. Basie had discovered how effective simplicity can be." Unquote. John Hammond became captivated by the new sound that Basie was making and began telling everyone he could about it, recommending that they tune in to the nightly broadcast, as well as speaking with the American Record Corporation to get an agreement in principle inked to record the band. This was 1936, and the Depression was easing as the swing era was beginning to take off. Hammond wasn't the only one to catch on to what Basie was doing in Kansas City, however. Joe Glazer from United Booking showed up to hear the band in Kansas City, but thought that basically Basie was like low energy and didn't see what the hype was all about. I guess maybe that's the difference between someone like John Hammond, who truly loved the music that he sourced, and someone like Joe Glazer, who is fundamentally a businessman. Maybe he's just not the kind of guy who's going to understand a revolution in understated playing. He did, however, manage to steal away trumpeter Hot Lips Page, with whom he was thoroughly impressed. Dave Capp from Decca also showed up in Kansas City and, claiming to represent the interests of John Hammond, signed Basie into a pretty lousy recording contract. Hammond arrived shortly and was distressed to find that Basie had been tricked into signing this deal. Under the terms of the contract, the band would be paid $750 a year to record 24 78 RPM sides a year for 3 years. That's 24 sides a year for 3 years, and they would get $750 for the whole band. The contracts also did not grant any royalties to Basie or the band, so they basically were treated as session players, only receiving the fee for the recording. Even though $750 would have seemed like a lot of money to Basie at the time, in reality, it wouldn't even meet AFM standard rates for studio fees. Hammond was able to take this provision to the union and have the fee raised at least to meet union standards. Now, this episode isn't about the history of the Basie band, but the story of Lester Young is very much intertwined with the story of Count Basie. This record deal meant that Young would be headed to Chicago with the band for the recording sessions. In other words, another foray into a major city, which was a prospect that left Young unimpressed and no doubt thinking back to his rough treatment in New York. The band did indeed have something of a rough start in Chicago. They were booked to play at the Grand Terrace, which is the sort of place you see depicted in movies from the era. There was a proper stage, polished dance floor, cigarette girls, basically a very sophisticated scene. Had the band been left to their own whims and allowed to basically do what they had been doing in Kansas City, there's little doubt that they would have been an immediate hit. The problem was that the Grand Terrace had a proper floor show, and when Basie arrived, he was handed a stack of music that the band was expected to play for the jugglers, acrobats, dancers, etc. Almost no one in the band, with the exception of Lester Young, due to his father's influence, could read the charts, and so the band was nearly sacked right away. To make matters worse, there had been a large amount of promotional hype announcing the band's imminent arrival in Chicago during the weeks leading up to their opening, which was then received with generally lousy reviews. Quote, "By the time you read this, they will be headed back to Kansas City," unquote, was a typical pronouncement of the band's virtues. Although this nearly disastrous start was probably a total drag for everyone in the band, it did lead to something of a breakthrough for Lester Young. Because the band was having such a rough time, Decca decided to delay the first of the recording sessions in order to give the group more time to settle into a cohesive unit. Upon hearing this, John Hammond decided to get his revenge on Decca for stealing the band away from him by recording them first. He took a small group consisting of Lester Young, Basie, Walter Page, Joe Jones, Tati Smith, and Jimmy Rushing to the American Record Corporation's Chicago studios late one night after they finished what was probably a pretty rough few hours at the Grand Terrace, and let the group loose. For the first time, Lester Young had been caught on tape for all to hear. Decades later, after what was really an incredible career in the music business, John Hammond would describe the three hours the group spent in the studio as, quote, "the only perfect, completely perfect recording session I ever had anything to do with," unquote. According to Gelly, when the sides from these sessions were released under the name Jones Smith Incorporated, they caused a bit of a stir because this was not what people expected the tenor saxophone to sound like. Here, more or less for the first time, was a serious rival to Coleman Hawkins, not only in terms of creative ability, but also in overall artistic vision for how the saxophone should sound. Historians love to make a big deal about these types of dichotomies, but I think that one of the wonderful things about our instrument is that it can be used to play so many different styles with such widely varying approaches in terms of sound. So this early fork in the stylistic road really does seem to be of major importance to me. I just want to take a minute to reflect on Young's early tone. He played with a lightness and a roundness that I think is a remarkable choice. It's clear that this type of sound matched his personality and that he was generally reserved and mild-mannered. I find it interesting that he would have developed this sound playing in the conditions in which he was regularly working. What I imagine would have been quite loud in raucous dance halls in Kansas City. It's not like he was whispering into a microphone and a giant PA or anything. The band would have had to put out a serious amount of volume to compete with the racket from dancers and general hangers-on. I just think it's interesting that he developed that sound in those conditions. I think it shows that his sound was big and not thin or unsupported as it has sometimes been described, particularly in comparison with Coleman Hawkins. The Basie Band wrapped up their opening at the Grand Terrace in Chicago on December 3rd and began the cold winter journey toward Manhattan, stopping in Buffalo and New London, Connecticut along the way. When the band arrived at the Roseland, the most popular ballroom in New York, they found themselves in a similar situation to their arrival in Chicago. A massive promotional effort had been made about this new hip band coming to town, but the audiences, who were exclusively white, didn't know what to make of the music and found the sets lacking the sort of, you know, tangos and other dance styles that they wanted. The slightly more sophisticated New York audiences were slightly more agreeable to the new style, but it wasn't much better than the reception the band received in Chicago. Dave Gelly points out an interesting stylistic divergence that can be heard in the early Basie recordings from this time. He describes how there are largely two types of tunes on the early Decca sides. The first is the Kansas City riff-style composition, which would lend themselves to endless soloing and reworking in live settings back in Missouri. And the second style are the more tightly orchestrated and fleshed-out tunes that were being added to the band's book as quickly as possible for audiences in East Coast ballrooms. Gelly notes that even though they're less developed, the riff tunes sound more fresh even today, while the tunes that were being written to accommodate society dancers now sound quite dated, frankly. Though the band didn't have the smoothest of starts in New York, they managed to keep the booking for 3 weeks and followed it up with another week at the Paramount Theater, meaning the band was in New York for a month straight. As was his habit, when in one place long enough to establish a routine, Lester Young would prowl the after-hours joints looking for jam sessions after the evening's work was finished. And it didn't take long for him to run across Billie Holiday again. It must have been quite a reunion for Young to have found Holiday again. Remember, she was one of the few bright spots in Young's time with the Fletcher Henderson band years before. It became a safe bet that if Billie Holiday was singing somewhere, it wouldn't be long before Lester Young would arrive and join her on stage. In fact, Young even moved in with Holiday and her mother after finding a rat in his shirt drawer at the Hotel Teresa in Harlem. Young also began recording in small group contexts with Holiday around this time, largely thanks to the efforts of John Hammond. Hammond had realized that the recently invented jukebox could be found throughout the nation, but that the devices often had little to offer to Black Americans. His solution was to put together small groups with a singer who would deliver a tune and then improvise an arrangement over the harmony. This was an effective method because, as we all know, it works. I mean, this is the basis for the idea of the standard tune, right? It was also effective from a business standpoint because the seemingly never-ending parade of great players coming through New York could turn out arrangements on the cheap without the need to hire an orchestrator. Most musicians received a simple fee of $20 for these sessions, which included Lester Young and Billie Holiday. On a side note, this theme of pumping out small group jazz records on the cheap to fill the vast demand of jukeboxes nationwide came up in the episode on Johnny Hodges as well. It's probably not a stretch to say that jazz and the record industry kind of came up together, and that the ability of jazz musicians to improvise and put things together on the fly was a major advantage for the art form in terms of getting it out into jukeboxes across the nation and making it popular. In addition to producing great early recordings of Lester Young and Billie Holiday, these small group sessions had an impact on the Basie band at large. After working with guitarist Freddie Green on the small group sessions, Joe Jones lobbied Basie and eventually succeeded in getting Green into the band. The other major addition was Billie Holiday. So just to check in with the timeline of things, we're in 1937 at this point. The band is on the road pretty relentlessly and not really making much money, though they're gaining a reputation for themselves. They traveled in a rickety bus that Joe Jones said traveled down the highway sideways due to its crooked body. It's not an easy existence, but the band is young and they're on the road making this new music. They're big on shooting dice in the bus, and the band even had a baseball team, which would play against other bands' teams. The bands led by Harry James and Benny Goodman also had baseball teams. Lester Young was the pitcher for the Basie team, by the way. Throughout much of 1938, the Basie band was traveling very little, at least by their standards. They mainly played long engagements in New York and occasionally made short trips into New England. I suppose this was probably good for the baseball team, and it was definitely good for Lester Young's recorded output. There are many, many recordings from this era, both small group things with Billie Holiday and also live broadcasts from the radio with the full band. The band ended 1938 by playing a concert at Carnegie Hall put together by John Hammond titled From Spirituals to Swing. The concept was an exposition of how jazz had been developing in America with the Basie contingent representing the swing side of that equation. Early in February of next year, a tragedy struck the band whilst on tour in Connecticut. Saxophonist Herschel Evans had been feeling unwell for some time and finally suffered a heart attack on stage. Evans and Young had become quite close and are sometimes described as an old bickering married couple. Young was devastated by his section mate's death, and were it not for Jack Washington wrangling him into his chair each night, Young likely would have followed his instinct to run away from unpleasant circumstances. In 1939, Europe's imminent slide into war saw Coleman Hawkins finally return to America. Upon his arrival, one of the first things he did was to record his famous version of Body and Soul, which became a massive hit nationwide and put him on a crash course for comparison with Lester Young. Now, I have to say, I think this controversy, the Young v. Hawkins debate, is just one of those controversies ginned up by journalists so that they have something to print. I mean, think about it. How can you really compare the two saxophonists in any meaningful way? Their playing styles are totally different. Their tones are polar opposite. Hell, even the way they stood was totally different. You can certainly say which style you prefer, but there really isn't a meaningful way to compare the two saxophonists in terms of quality. That being said, it was quite common for the two saxophonists to face off at jam sessions around Harlem. One such incident took place at Puss Johnson's Tavern, and someone from Downbeat just happened to be on the scene and reported that Hawkins won the day. This in turn drew an angry letter from Billie Holiday claiming that, quote, Prez had cut the hawk, unquote, and it seems that the publication and rebuttal sparked something of a national argument, at least amongst jazz fans, as to who was the stronger saxophonist. The whole thing seems kind of silly to me, though it would have been incredible to hear some of those sessions with the two tenormen going toe-to-toe. While these types of controversies are indeed pretty dumb, it's probably fair to say that the supposed rivalry between the two did create a bit of a narrative for them and likely raised the profiles of both players. On Friday the 13th in December of 1940, Lester Young failed to show up for a recording session with the Basie Band. When contacted, he reportedly replied with, "Go away and let me sleep. A man's got no business making music on Friday the 13th. Lester Young parted ways with Count Basie, and neither party had anything to say about why or what had happened. Or at least that's the story that was read by surprised and bewildered Downbeat readers the following January. Neither Young nor Basie would give a straight answer when asked about the saxophonist's departure, and there hasn't really ever been an official explanation from either party that I'm aware of. Dave Gelly suggests that the band was going through a bit of a rough patch with a change in management, leaving the band with fewer bookings and greater travel distances between one-nighters. This wasn't such a big deal for Count Basie because he would just jump in as a featured soloist with Benny Goodman when his own band wasn't working. But it caused a lot of problems for guys like Lester Young, you know, who were just like sidemen. And so if the band doesn't work, then they're not working. Young had also asked for a pay rise as he was becoming a known soloist and rates for band members were generally going up at the time. Apparently, Basie consulted with John Hammond, who advised him that he couldn't really afford to pay Young anymore at the time, which in turn got back to Lester and sparked an enduring resentment toward Hammond. Gelly also suggests that Young wasn't so interested in the direction the band was heading in terms of playing formal arrangements rather than the more improvisatory style from its roots. It sounds to me like he must have been thinking, you know, I'm just not into the music and the pay isn't right. And so he just got like kind of fed up with it and quit, which makes sense to me. What doesn't make quite as much sense is that he didn't really have any sort of plan in place when he left Basie. Dave Gelly has a really nice paragraph that sums up Lester's dilemma of striking out on his own. Quote, Lester Young was shy, sweet-natured, impractical, and apt to run away at the first sign of trouble or conflict. He was in his element on the back seat of a tour bus, commenting on the passing scene in his private language, giving his friends funny names, smoking pot, shooting craps, and losing money. The neutral observer would readily conclude that here was not one of nature's bandleaders. Unquote. I just think that's such an elegant description of Lester Young and why it was pretty unlikely that he would go out on his own as a leader. I think that's where we'll leave it for part one of the Lester Young story. There's plenty more to come, and I'm going to get it out pretty quickly this week, so you won't have to wait quite a long time like has happened with some of my other episodes. Thanks very much for listening, and you know, please feel free to get in touch via my website if you have any comments or you want to quarrel with me about anything. That's andrewdmeyer.com. AndrewDmeyer.com. I hope I just spelled my own name right. That's kind of embarrassing. Anyway, please like and subscribe and leave a review if you get a chance. And I'll catch you next time on the Saxophone History Podcast for the rest of the Lester Young story.